Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 89. I'm recording it on Sunday, February 1st, 2009. The PE10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong, long-term value proposition. The music for this podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of this selection is Just As Soon. The title of the podcast is The Equity Risk Premium Explained at Last, Perhaps. The last podcast I did was a fun one. It was called Predicting Presidential Success Using PE10. And I explained at the beginning of that podcast that the ideas being put forward there are tentative. Don't take them too seriously, although I think it was a helpful analytical exercise to go through to see how overvaluation in stocks affects not only stock investors, but affects the entire economy. And by affecting the economy, it affects whether our elected leaders are successful or not in their pursuits, because the success or failure of the economy affects us all in hundreds of different ways. This podcast is also tentative, so please don't take it super serious. I think the ideas are worth exploring, the ideas I'm going to put forward in this podcast, and so I do want to put them forward, but I haven't been able to explore them in enough depth, and I haven't had enough other people check them out, and I haven't been able to do even enough research to really say that I have a high confidence in them. But so they're tentative. They're thoughts that I'm putting forward rather than ideas that I have a great deal of confidence in. But I think they're worth considering. And the question we're going to explore is the equity risk premium. So first I need to say what that is. In our understanding of how stock investing works, and as I've said on many occasions, our understanding of how stock investing works is primitive today. So we need to start all of these discussions with an understanding that we don't know everything. I think that's critical, because when you think you know more than you do, you get hung up. You start to believe things that are not so, and instead of learning, you're spending all your energies trying to block out new learning, trying to protect your pride. So I think we need to look at some of these questions that have been around and have been discussed by lots of smart people, lots of people a lot smarter than Rob Bennett, to be sure, for a long time now, and they have not solved the puzzles. But that may be because they're just not looking in the right place. That's what I have come to believe over the first 7 years of our discussion, our investing discussions in the Retire Early and Indexing discussion board communities. So what is the equity risk premium? Well, in the conventional theory of how stock investing works, you could call it the passive investing theory. It's a theory that's not really the idea of passive investing, but it's connected. It's all part of the same theoretical framework. The usual way of explaining different asset classes provide different sorts of returns. You've probably noticed that if you put your money in a money market account, you won't get much of a return. Maybe 1% real, maybe 2% real. If you put your money in something like TIPS or I-bonds, you get a little more than that, maybe 3% real. If you put your money in bonds, you'll get more in the long term. You might get 4% real. I don't know the exact numbers, but clearly you would get more. If you put your money in stocks, you get a lot more. You get the The average long-term return on stocks is in the U.S. is 6.5% real. So even if bonds were providing 5% real, stocks are providing more than a full percentage point greater than that. The way that stock experts explain this is they say that you're being compensated for risk. So if you are a timid sort of soul and you want to know exactly how much money you have at all times and you want to be able to take your money out and hold it and not have a, you know, not have to go through the angst or the anxiety of some days having X amount of savings and other days having Y amount, you might put your money in a money market fund and you're compensated for doing so because you're giving up the use of your money, but you're not compensated very much because you're not willing to take on risk. You're not willing to take on a chance of losing your money. So you don't really have to be compensated very much. You know, everybody would be willing to do that. It's sort of a supply-demand argument. Everybody would be happy. You know, if you could get 6.5% in a money market, everybody would do it. So as a result, when somebody's offering you a return in order to get your money into a money market account, they don't need to offer you 6.5 because everyone would grab that deal. They can offer you 1% or 2% and they'll get enough customers happy to take that deal to be able to keep their money market operating. For TIPS or I-bonds, there's a little more risk. You don't really have risk of losing your principal and you don't have inflation risk, but you have to tie up your money for a longer amount of time than you would putting your money in a money market. So that's a form of risk that you don't have quick access to the funds. So that's a form of risk. And so your return's a little bit higher, your real return. And when you go with bonds are significantly more risky because if we head into a high inflation time, the value of your bonds could decline. So there's a risk of the loss of principal. So you're going to get higher return in bonds, but not as high as stocks because bonds are not as volatile as stocks. You do get big losses in bonds, but you don't get these catastrophic losses as we've recently seen in the stock market. So bonds, I don't know what the average long-term return on bonds is, but it could be 4% or 5% real. I don't know what it is. And I'm sure it depends on the type of bond. But it's less than stocks, significantly less than stocks. And so economists and stock analysts have debated this question for a good number of years now. They understand, their theory explains why stocks would pay a higher return. Nobody has trouble understanding that. It makes sense that stocks would provide the highest return because stocks are the most risky, or at least they are perceived to be the most risky. I have questions as to whether that's really true, but that's a separate podcast. And we've talked about it in some earlier podcasts. But people understand why the return on stocks is higher. What they don't understand is why it is as much higher. Most people feel that the return on stocks should be a bit higher, but they argue that stocks aren't really all that terribly risky. And this is where you come into the stocks for the long run argument. The argument is that if you know what you're doing with stocks, and of course, the whole passive investing argument, the whole idea of stocks for the long run, this sort of thing, buy and hold, you know, all these concepts have been widely publicized now for at least 30 years. So the feeling is this information has been, you know, widely disseminated. And under this theory, under this passive investing theory, stocks are risky, but they're not so terribly risky as long as you're willing to hold them for the long term. So the question that a lot of people have raised in academic articles and this sort of thing is, you know, articles in financial journals, why is the risk premium on stocks so high? Why do stocks provide in the U.S. 6.5% real? Shouldn't it be more like maybe 5% real or 5.5% real, not 6.5% real? And it's a tantalizing sort of question. There was a fellow, Jim Glassman, who wrote a book that I often see it ridiculed today, and I think that's a little unfortunate. I thought the book made an interesting point. The book was called Dow 36,000. James Glassman, and he had a co-author. I don't know the co-author's name. The book came out at the height of the out-of-control bull market. It came out, I believe, in the late 90s. And it was popular. It was a popular book. But, of course, at that time, a lot of people were looking for, you know, rationalizations for believing that stocks were going to continue going up. Many people were over-invested in stocks. And so it's not hard to understand why that book would be popular. But I feel that, unfortunately, the book has been almost reduced to a cartoon. The title was a good title in that it attracted attention. But now people, and I'm sure the title helped to sell the book. Dow 36,000 was, you know, people instantly knew what the book said. They instantly knew what it was about, and they wanted to buy it. And now it's mocked, because now we have Dow 8,000, and, you know, years later, 10 years later. So people feel that the Dow 36,000 prediction did not come through. And it, you know, that's quite fair. The prediction did not come through. The premise of the book, well, you can't say the book has been totally discredited. It could be that its argument, there's something to it. But certainly we haven't achieved Dow 36,000 as soon as the authors anticipated at the time they published the book. So there's something wrong with the book. Perhaps not everything, but something. But what I liked about the book, and I did not read the book, but I read a number of articles about it, so I think I understand the argument, although I did not read the book itself. The argument in the book I found very interesting. I think it was an intelligent argument, even if wrong. I believe the argument was wrong, but I believe it was intelligent and worth consideration. The argument in the book was that, you know, stocks have provided a return of 6.5% real for a long time. This goes back many decades. You get the entire history of the U.S. stock market, really, as far back as we have records. The argument in the book is that the reason why stocks have provided such a high return for so long is that we didn't understand stocks. Most investors didn't understand stocks. And that we entered a new age with development of the passive investing theory. Passive investing / efficient market theory. Efficient market theory is the intellectual underpinning of the passive investing concept. And now, the authors argued, we now understand how stock investing works. We now know that the trick to not losing your money in stocks is investing for the long term. And that if you do that, stocks are just an amazing deal. This is the whole passive investing argument. And what Glassman and his co-author argued is, if that's true, and they certainly believed it was true, as did millions of others, I do not. But if that's true, then it would make sense. Two things would follow. One, stock prices would shoot to the moon. If it were really true that we had learned something fundamental about how stocks work, and the stocks for the long run concept is a fundamental breakthrough insight. The passive investing concept is a fundamental breakthrough insight, if true. If it were all true, then Glassman argued stocks shouldn't go up to 12,000, which is where they were at the high point of the bull market. I think they were a little under 12,000, the Dow. They should shoot up to somewhere around 36,000. In a relatively short amount of time. I don't think he gave a year, but the premise was that it was going to be in the near future, not the distant future. And I think that makes sense. If stocks were what they were advertised to be during the passive investing years, stocks were underpriced. Glassman is right. They're, you know, anything that offers you 6.5% real, you should be buying like crazy. So I think Glassman's logic follows. And the second point that, you know, the one point he made is that stock prices were going to shoot to the moon. The second point was that when they got to the moon, and this is the part that people ignore, and I think it's unfair. People don't say that Glassman said this, and it's a critical part of his argument because it's the part that makes his argument sensible. He said, if we go to Dow 36,000, the risk premium will be greatly reduced. The returns on stocks in the future will be greatly reduced. Stocks in the future will not pay 6.5% real ever again. Because now that we understand how stocks work, we don't need that higher risk premium to be enticed into buying them. And again, I think the logic chain there is strong. I think Glassman makes a lot of sense. I think the argument of the book makes a lot of sense. The problem, so what Glassman was arguing is you better buy stocks fast because over the next 10 years or so, at the time he wrote the book, the late 1980s, over the next 10 years or so, stocks are going to offer the best deal they've ever offered in history, because learning how stock investing works for the first time is something that can only be done once. And so when we all learn how stock investing works, which is what passive investing does for us, everyone's going to buy stocks. Massive amounts of money are going to shift to stocks, and stocks are going to skyrocket. They're going to go to 36,000, but then from that point forward, stocks aren't going to pay any more than bonds. I don't know what number he said the return would drop to, but it would drop below 6.5% real, drop to 5% or something like that. I don't know, maybe less. I think if you went to 36,000, it would drop to less than that, but I don't know exactly what his numbers were. As I say, I didn't read the book. I just read reviews of it. I think the logic there is strong. What Glassman was really doing, in my opinion, is he was looking at the logic chain that supports passive investing, and he was taking it seriously. See, a lot of people, I think, use it as a marketing gimmick. Not that they're insincere, but a lot of people buy into it. And they get excited about it, and ordinary investors, they just buy the stocks. But the people who promote stocks, they use the passive investing arguments as a sales technique. And I think that they believe it. It's not that they're being dishonest, but I don't know what word to use. They're not being... I'm tempted to say their arguments lack intellectual integrity. That's too strong. They lack conviction. They lack intellectual conviction. What they're doing is they're saying, oh yes, we've discovered the secret of stock investing. Stocks for the long run, you can't time the market, buy and hold. But they use these phrases as a way to get people excited about stocks and buy stocks. And they're buying them themselves. They're not trying to trick people. They believe it. But if they really believe these arguments, they should go where Glassman went. Because if you really believe that with Eugene Fama and Burton Malkiel and John Bogle, if you really believe that these people have discovered the secret of stock investing, then I think what Glassman said makes sense. Stocks are going to shoot to the moon. And they're never again, if they shoot to the moon, they're never again going to provide such high returns. Both of those things follow. That there's a window of opportunity to buy stocks, 10 years or so, starting in the late 90s. Now that 10 years is up now, but after that, stocks will just be another investment class. In other words, what he's saying is that what made stocks so great for so long. See, this is the mystery. There are a lot of articles in the literature. You know, the famous one I think is called the equity risk premium puzzle. People, academics are always trying to understand this. They can't make sense of it. It doesn't fit. It's an element of the theory that doesn't fit, and it gnaws at them. It's like a loose tooth. It bothers them. But what Glassman was putting forward as his premise, as I understand it, and I again point out that I did not actually read the book, so it's possible I don't understand it fully, but this is how I understand it. What Glassman was doing, he was offering a perfectly good explanation. He was saying, there's been a risk premium because we didn't understand stocks. So, you know, anytime you're asked to engage in an activity you don't understand, you're going to want compensation for that. You're taking a chance, and you know, it's sort of like if someone was asking you to perform a certain task, you know, if someone's asking you to pick them up at the bank, you know, they might pay you the rate of a cab driver. You know, they're going to pay you a small amount of money to drive your car and pick them up. But if you know that they're committing a bank robbery and you have a chance of going to jail and there's all this risk involved, you're going to ask for a lot more money to do the job. You're not going to do it for $10. You're going to want, you know, $10,000. So if passive investing is the discovery of how stock investing works, and the efficient market theory is the discovery of how stock investing works, and that is indeed how it's been marketed, you know, we were all dumb before Eugene Fama came along. We were all dumb before Burton Malkiel came along. We were all dumb before John Bogle came along. Everybody was dumb. But now we all get it. Now we've discovered the truth. Now we've got scientific approach to investing. Now we've got academic studies. If that's true, and James Glassman believes it, if that's true, I think he's right. Stock prices should go to the moon. And then never again should stocks provide the sorts of returns that they've always provided in the past. And see, people leave out that part. When they're talking about Glassman, they leave out the part about stocks never again providing those returns, and I think that's unfortunate because it makes him sound like he's, he's just a get-rich-quick guy. He's saying Dow 36,000, you know, like he's a goofball. Whereas as Bogle and Malkiel, they try to position themselves as serious. But Glassman is really the more serious of this group, in my view, because he takes the ideas to their logical conclusion, which is what you should do. If you're intellectually serious, you should take them to their logical conclusion. Now, I think he's wrong, but the beauty of taking it to the logical conclusion is you can see the errors. You can look at the logic chain up close and discover the errors in it. And of course, today, Glassman is considered discredited because we didn't go to 36,000. So he's been made to look like a fool. But I don't think he's the fool. I think he helped us understand reality by exploring the logic chain, putting the logic chain under a microscope. And I think the foolish thing is the theory. The foolish thing is the passive investing theory. I've talked about that many times. But I want to look in this podcast at the equity risk premium and try to explore, let's say that the new idea, I believe the great new idea about stock investing is not passive investing. I believe the great new idea is rational investing, which is the opposite. What I believe is that passive investing got us halfway there. It did. The people who came up with the passive investing idea were filled with wonderful insights. That I think is beyond question. So it was an exciting time when Eugene Fama came up with his ideas and Burton Malkiel added some wonderful insights and John Bogle has added many wonderful insights and so forth. But there's a fundamental flaw. And the fundamental flaw, you've heard me describe it many times, is that the efficient market theory, the passive investing concept, does not take into consideration valuations. It assumes that investors are rational. Doesn't prove it. It assumes it. And so all of the research that supports the passive investing model is structured in such a way so that it doesn't show the effect of valuations. It just assumes it out. They believe in passive investing, so they set up their studies to make no adjustment. And of course, when you make no adjustment, you show no effect. But then in practical terms, how do they invest? They don't change their allocation based on valuations. Make no change. It's crazy. anyone coming to investing from the outside, which is the way I did it, I'm no investing expert. I didn't go to school for 20 years to study investing. I don't manage any big funds. Anyone coming from the outside would say, why don't you change your allocation when prices go nuts? You know, am I missing something? That doesn't make any sense. They say, oh, academic studies, timing doesn't work. You know, they've got answers, but all of their answers are based on these studies, which exclude valuations when they set up the methodology. So of course, the studies show that valuations don't have an effect. If you exclude it from the study, you're not going to find it. But lo and behold, studies have been done in the last 30 years that look at valuations, and when you consider valuations, they have a huge effect, just as your common sense tells you must be so. So we now have studies coming from the other direction showing that valuations do have an effect and that all the passive investing stuff doesn't stand up to scrutiny. So those studies are the basis for the rational investing school. Those studies say you must change your allocation in response to big price changes. I think that this shift, let's assume there's going to be a shift in current in coming days from passive investing to rational investing. Rob Arnott, a big name in the field, he's served as editor of the Financial Analyst Journal for a number of years, the most prestigious journal in the field. Rob Arnott has said he believes that we are on the threshold of a revolution in our understanding of how stock investing works. I think that's right. I think the revolution is going to be a shift from the passive investing model that says you do not need to change your stock allocation to the rational investing model, which says you must change your stock allocation. And most investing discussions, 80% of what we should be talking about is when to change your stock allocation and how much to change your stock allocation. And that's really the whole subject. That's what we all need to discuss. And passive investing took all of the most important issues off the table, and by doing so caused the biggest economic catastrophe in the history of the United States, the biggest loss of middle-class income in the history of the United States. So let's say that the passive investing era died in September of 2008 in the massive passive investing stock crash of 2008. Let's say this era is behind us and we're in the very early stages of building a new model for understanding how stock investing works. And this model is rational investing, and rational investing adopts many of the principles of passive investing, and the idea of investing for the long term. We follow the idea of stay the course, except we define it differently. We say that staying the course means not sticking to the same stock allocation, but sticking to the same risk level, which means changing your allocation. When prices get high and the risk is extreme, you go with a lower stock allocation so that you keep your risk level roughly constant. So let's say that's happening. If we make a switch to rational investing, and we start thinking through the perspective of a rational investor, I think it's possible that we can explain away the equity risk premium. And this idea was put into my head by a poster at the Vanguard Diehards board named Hockey Mike. And Hockey Mike was, I thought he was basically a good guy. I sort of liked talking with him, but he was hostile. He was definitely hostile to the rational investing concept or the valuation-informed indexing strategy. I don't think I was calling it rational investing at the time. I was calling the strategy valuation-informed indexing, and he was hostile. But one of his hostile questions, I sometimes, you know, you'll see me respond to hostile posters, and I never do so in a hostile way. But sometimes I'll respond to them in a very polite way, and I've had people ask me, Rob, you know, why do you even talk to these jerks? And the reason I talk to these quote-unquote jerks is that I sometimes learn from them. You know, as long as when they get into the nasty personal stuff, there's nothing to learn. It's just a big waste of time. And that's when, you know, I'll ask, you know, the site owners to get involved, or if they don't get involved, my fellow community members to get involved, to try to, you know, tone down the personal attacks so that those of us trying to learn can learn from each other. But so long as they're asking questions, I think we can learn from them. And this was a case where I felt I learned something important from a hostile questioner. I would describe, usually I didn't develop the valuation-informed indexing strategy. It's basically just indexing as you've always heard it, but with the difference that you don't stick with the same stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels. When prices become very dangerous, you lower your stock allocation with the goal of keeping your risk level roughly constant. So we were at extremely high valuations from 1995 through the first part of 2008. So during those years, if you had been following valuation-informed indexing strategy, you would have been heavily invested in stocks from 1975 through 1995. 1975, stock prices were low. You might have been going with a stock allocation of about 80%. And you would have stayed with a high stock allocation all the way through 1995. Stocks provided wonderful returns throughout all those years. Now, not everybody would be at 80. Some, you know, it depends on your personal circumstances. Some would be at 70 or 60. But if you were a young person and you were fairly aggressive, you might have been at 80. Stocks offer a tremendous long-term value proposition. So going by the numbers, at least, that would make sense. For some, it's just too high. Some just can't take that level of risk. But if you're a young person and your job is secure, and you were going mainly by the numbers, you would have gone with something around 80%. But then when prices reached insanely dangerous levels, you would have dropped your allocation to perhaps 20% or 30%, something in that neighborhood. And that was the case from 1995 through the first part of 2008. So when we had a stock crash, you would have, you know, if in a 50% stock crash, if you were at a 20% allocation, you would have lost 10% of your portfolio value. That's a hit, but it's a hit that you could withstand. It's a hit that, you know, much less than the hit suffered by passive investors. And then, of course, when prices return to reasonable levels, you can increase your stock allocation again. Now, the purpose of valuation-informed indexing was, it was really risk diminishment. The purpose was the idea behind it was you should be staying the course, but I feel that staying the course should mean staying at the same risk level. And stocks are obviously more risky when the prices are at insane levels, so it just makes sense to me that you would lower your allocation in order to bring your risk back to where you had always intended it to be. It's never made any sense to me to stay at the same stock allocation. That idea is just foreign to me. But that was the purpose. The purpose was on the risk side. But what Hockey Mike argued, he said, "Oh, Rob," he says, "you're not really trying to help people with risk." And I said, "Well, why do you say that?" He says, "Oh," he says, "you're just trying to give people better returns." He says, "Aren't you saying that returns would be better with valuation-informed indexing?" And he's right. He was trying to paint me as some sort of, get-rich-quick artist. And that's not at all where I was coming from. What I was, you know, I started out on the retirement side, you know, with the safe withdrawal rate studies. The safe withdrawal rate studies were the old school safe withdrawal rate studies were recommending these extreme high risk portfolios for retirees and telling them they were safe. And I just thought that was reckless and dangerous. And so I started out on the side that we ought to be able to tell people accurate numbers for planning their retirements. It was a risk prevention idea, not a return. I didn't start out saying, how do you get higher returns? But Hockey Mike made me think about it because he's right, and I couldn't figure out any way he was wrong. And so ever since then, I've sort of stored that idea away, and I've sort of thought about it from time to time. And the returns have to be higher with valuation-informed indexing. And the reason is the returns, the overall return in the U.S. market is 6.5% real. That's, I mean, it's a number. I don't see how you can argue with it. It's an historical fact. So the universe, unless I have some flaw in my thinking, and if I do, please let me know. But I can't see it. The universe of investors is getting 6.5% real in the long term. That has to be so. But passive investors have to be getting worse. They can't be getting the average return, because passive investing, the worst thing you can do in stock investing is to buy heavily into stocks at times of high prices and to sell heavily at times of low prices. And passive investing encourages people to do just that. Because when prices are high, our common sense tells us to cut back. But passive investing says, no, don't cut back. Stay at the same stock allocation. Overinvest in stocks at times of insanely dangerous prices. That's the passive investing message. That's what it's all about. So passive investing encourages us to overinvest in stocks at times of high prices, when the value proposition is poor. On the other hand, it then, of course, causes you to suffer devastating losses. Inevitably, people act like this is a surprise, but it's 100% predictable. I mean, we've tried this passive investing approach 4 times in history, and every single time it has brought devastating losses to all who followed it. So I feel that at this point we ought to be beginning to detect a pattern. But of course, it has to do that, because if you tell people they don't need to change to lower their stock allocation, well, you know, at some point the idea is going to catch on, and once it catches on, that's going to send prices even higher. So you start out with high prices, and then you make them higher. You increase the danger. Well, stocks have to return to normal prices. Otherwise, the market would collapse. So sooner or later, those high prices are going to crash. And when they crash, people are going to be devastated if they had high stock allocations. And if they're devastated, they're going to sell. You know, all of this is common sense. I really don't think I should have to argue it. How could anything be more obvious? So people are now starting to sell, obviously. You know, Taylor Larimore says he's thinking of selling his stocks, going to zero stock allocation. He's the co-author of The Boglehead's Guide to Investing. Bill Bangen is the author of one of the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. He's got his clients at zero stocks. Frugal Dad writes a blog. Great blog. You know, he has an amazing, the guy has an amazing work ethic. He amazes me. And he doesn't write about investing often, but he wrote the other week and he said he's thinking of getting out of stocks because of all the human misery he's seen it cause. People he knows and people on his blog. So people are talking about getting out of stocks. So the passive investors will be now switching to very low stock, not all of them, but a lot of them, and we may see another stock crash, you know, in years to come, in the not too distant future, you know, 2-3 years down the road, if, you know, it could well be another stock crash of 50% or more. Well, if we see another crash of 50%, even more people are going to get out of stocks. So the passive investors the rational investors aren't getting out. Rational investors are increasing their allocation. The long-term value proposition is now good. And the rational investors didn't suffer the devastating price drop. And we have data going back to 1870, and the data shows that rational investing has always outperformed passive investing. You can check this out at the Scenario Surfer calculator at my website. It always outperforms. So if there's one, the universe of investors is basically divided into passive investors, emotional investors, and rational investors, investors who look at the historical data and invest according to the probabilities. Those are the two groups. Those are the two competing strategies, strategic possibilities. Rational investors always do better, so it follows that passive investors always do worse. And the long-term return really is 6.5% real. So that means rational investors must be getting more than 6.5% real. I think Hockey Mike is right. What I recommend, I did not intend to come up with an investing strategy that gave higher returns. But I did, not meaning to. But what I was trying to do was reduce risk. And by reducing risk, I reduced losses. And by reducing losses, I accidentally came up with an investing strategy that allows much higher long-term returns. Because when you cut out losses, or you don't cut them out, but you diminish them greatly, you end up, you know, you get compounding. That's the thing that I think people miss. They look at this and they say, well, I can see how it's better, but I'm going to stick with passive. Passive's good enough. What they don't see is that, and you see this when you use the scenario surfer, you might go 10 years with passive earning returns as high as rational, or even better. But then you'll have a price crash, and rational zooms ahead. And then at the end of 30 years, it's way ahead. And the reason is because once it goes ahead, it gains the benefit of compounding. And the returns just keep building and building and building. And the passive investor can never catch up. I've seen that pattern over and over again when I use the scenario surfer. Scenario surfer lets you go through a 30-year sequence of returns, using returns that are based on the returns you would get in the real world. Based on returns from the historical data. That pattern just repeats over and over again. That the two strategies sort of compete. Passive investing sometimes nudges a little bit ahead. But then there's 1 year or 2 years when rational zooms to the front, and then passive can never catch up. And that's because of compounding. So it seems to me. So I didn't intend, I wasn't trying to, I never would have presumed to have been able to figure out a way to earn higher returns. It's just not something I would have thought I could do. But I sort of backed into it accidentally. But Hockey Mike is right. He was making the argument to put me down. But I think his argument holds water. Valuation-informed indexing gives higher returns than conventional indexing. So that's nice. Now, take that to the next stage in the logic chain. To explain the equity risk premium. Rational investing, the strategy is valuation-informed indexing, but the model is rational investing. Rational investing is looking at valuations, letting valuations influence your allocation. Rational investing gives higher returns, higher than 6.5. We know that the long-term return is 6.5, passive gets lower than 6.5, and rational gets higher. Now, most investors were trying to understand, why is the risk premium so high? Why is it that stocks have to provide a return of 6.5% real to attract enough investors? Why? I think we've just explained it. Most investors don't get 6.5. Most investors are passive/emotional. It's always been a minority of investors that follow the rational approach, the rational probabilistic approach. So let's say 90% of the investing population is passive/emotional, 10% is rational, probabilistic. That means that I don't know what the numbers are, but it could well mean that the passives are only getting 5% real. They're not getting 6.5. That would explain the equity risk premium being so high. What it would mean is that most investors aren't getting any more in stocks than they get in bonds. They're not getting an equity risk premium. And if the return on stocks were to drop any lower, people wouldn't invest in them. Now, you see, during the bull market, people think, that sounds crazy. Everybody loves stocks. We all know stocks are great. But what people are doing during a bull market is they're allowing temporary conditions to influence their thinking. They're thinking people always feel that way. But bull markets, certainly the type of insane bull market we had from 95 through 2008, that's not a normal condition. That's the weirdest, strangest condition you'll ever see. The normal condition is a PE 10 level where we are today, 14. That's normal. And today, people are scared to death of stocks. If we see another 50% price drop, and that's what we've always seen, the three other times when we went to insane bull markets, we saw a price drop to 50% below where we are today. If we see that, we're going to have people swearing off stocks for the rest of their life. And of course, that's what's happened in the past. We all have, you know, grandfathers that we ask them about stocks, and they say, I'm not investing in stocks. I hear all this baloney on the TV. I'm never investing in stocks. They lost money in one of the earlier insane bull markets, and they learned their lesson. And ultimately, there's a lot of people in that circumstance. You know, when stocks become popular, they become popular with everybody. So when stocks devastate people, they become unpopular with everybody. And for this asset class to be able to entice enough people to invest in it, it's got to win a large percentage of those people back. That's sort of the job. And the risk premium has to be high enough to break down the resistance of those people. And that resistance is high. In other words, we've explained, I think, it's a tentative thought, but I think we've explained the risk premium. The reason why the average return on stocks has to be so great, so absurdly great, is that only 10% of the population is getting that return. 90% isn't getting it. 90% is following up, 90% are following a passive strategy, which means they're greatly over-investing in stocks at times of high prices. Insane, absurdly over-invested in stocks. And then, because of their absurd over-investment, they're suffering bone-crushing losses in the inevitable price crash, and then selling. Which means, it's not that they get no return. You know, if you bought in 2000 and you sell in 2009, you'd have a negative return. But that's the most unlucky case. But a lot of these people didn't buy in 2000. They might have bought in 95. And they had gains in 96, 97, 98, 99. And then from 2000, 2008, they had dead money. They didn't have gains. They didn't have big losses. And then they had a crash. And I don't know, you know, you can do the numbers where they would stand. Maybe they're a break even or something. Maybe a little better than break even. Maybe they're earning what they would have earned, you know, in tips or something. But they didn't get a risk premium. If they bought in 90, well, they would get a risk premium. But how great it would be, you'd have to do the numbers. But the point is, a large group of investors are going to turn out having a negative return on their stock investment. Not 6.5% real. Negative return. Some are going to end up breaking even. Some are going to end up with a return close to what they would have gotten with a risk-free asset class like TIPS or I-bonds. Some are going to end up with a return equivalent to what they would have gotten in bonds. Not a bad return. 4% real, maybe 5% real. But it's going to be a rare passive investor who's going to end up with 6.5% real, if any. There might not be any. And then you'll have the rational investors who are going to earn a lot more than 6.5. The ones who adjusted their allocations in response to big changes in prices, they'll be getting not 6.5. They'll be getting 8, 9, 10% real in the long as their long-term return. But you see, the risk premium, the 10% real is, of course, absurd. There should never be any investment class that would provide 10% real. That's nuts. That's an insanely high return, especially for an index investor. You don't even have to pick stocks. You don't even have to do any research. It's all done for you. How could it be? This is where the passive investors will get angry and start stamping their feet. They'll say, there is no free lunch. You can't beat the market. You know, there's no way you could get that kind of return. Well, you couldn't get that kind of return if investing were rational. That is true. Their argument is rooted in something sensible. It's insane that you could get that kind of return. But what the rational investors are doing is they're taking advantage of the fact that that investing is a highly emotional endeavor, and they're just holding on to their common sense. They're not buying into the passive investing nonsense. They're just saying, no, I'm going to look at price with stocks just like I look with price with everything else, and I don't care what they say on television, and I don't care what they say in the books and magazines. I'm doing it. And if you do it, you know, go to the website, check out the calculator. You'll see that there will be times when you'll be down. You know, in 95, you would have lowered your stock allocation. You would have been down in 96, 97, 98, 99. But you won't be down in the long term. The long term, you'll always be up. On a risk-adjusted basis, rational investing always beats passive investing. Always. On a risk-adjusted basis. So the rational investors are getting absurd returns. That I agree with. But that's, the risk premium isn't aimed at rational investors. If rational investors are only 10% of the population, the risk premium is the purpose of the risk premium is to entice large numbers of investors to invest in stocks. If only 10% of the population were investing in stocks, that wouldn't be enough. So the return on stocks has to be pumped up high enough to entice lots of investors. And to entice passive investors, you'd have to have a return a lot higher than bonds, because passive investors don't get the average return. They're not getting the 6.5. See, what I'm saying here is that the 6.5 is sort of a myth. It's accurate. The numbers are accurate, but no one has ever measured how many investors get it. I've never seen such data. What percentage of investors get 6.5? My guess is it's a tiny, tiny percentage, perhaps 10%. So I think that explains the risk premium, that what's going on is that so few investors get it. It's essentially there's leakage. What's happening is there's leakage. 6.5% is the number that applies on an overall basis. But because investing is so emotional an endeavor, most people aren't getting it. We've managed to construct investing theories that stop us from getting the average return. I mean, of course, this is totally counterintuitive, as is so much of this material. You would think people would be happy to get the average return. Why would anyone try to concoct a way to lower their return so that they don't get 6.5? Well, if we were rational, we wouldn't. But you see, we're not. This is the whole theory of rational investing is that we should be rational. You see, the theory of passive investing, what passive investing does is it assumes rationality. It never shows it. It assumes it. And that's the worst thing you can do. Because when you assume it, You turn a blind eye to all emotion. You just whenever anything appears emotional, you just say that can't be. There's no such thing as emotion. I won't look at it. That's what valuations are. Overvaluation is just emotion. That's what it is. And passive investors ignore it. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Market's always right. No such thing as overvaluation. Market gets the price right. So they ignore emotion. When you ignore emotion, emotion kills you. The whole idea of rational investing is not to ignore emotion. It's to acknowledge emotion, acknowledge the effect of valuations. When you acknowledge it, you can counter it. Not perfectly. Rational investors are not perfectly rational. They strive to be rational. That's the difference. By striving, we get closer than by pretending we've already done it. Pretending you're rational is defensive. It's really the most emotional strategy of all. By denying emotion, you empower your emotions. So what's happening is the passive investors are actually going out of their way to lower their return. As crazy as that sounds, that is the reality, I believe. The 6.5% return is just sitting there. It's just the average return. You don't have to be Warren Buffett to get 6.5% real. It's just sitting there waiting for you to pick it up. But if you become a passive investor, you forfeit it. You can't earn that. It becomes impossible because you're overinvesting at times of high prices, and then inevitably, if you overinvest at times of high prices, you're going to be forced to underinvest at times of low prices because you're going to suffer bone-crushing losses sooner or later. And the rational investor, by keeping his risk level constant, he's able to invest for the long term. He's able to walk the buy and hold walk instead of just talking the buy and hold talk. And when you walk the buy and hold walk, you really get the 6.5 real. You actually get more. What happens is you're sort of doubly rewarded. You're rewarded with the 6.5 by being rational, and then you're rewarded by more because of the irrationality of the passive investor. So you end up, you get a super risk premium because the only way stocks can get restore, the only way stocks can get people to invest in them again is by offering these absurdly high returns, and the rational investor gets to keep them, whereas the passive investor ends up losing them. Part of what's being said here is that, oh, how can I say this? It's a very interesting concept. What really matters in trying to attract money to stocks is not what we think about stocks at any moment in time. What really matters is what we know about stocks in our memory. In other words, at any given time, there are people who love stocks, people who are moderate about stocks, and people who hate stocks. What the equity risk premium is trying to do is to entice, it's trying to push the return up as, you know, it's not a person, it doesn't really have a brain, but it's trying to do this mechanically. It's trying to entice people to invest in stocks. And the question is, how high a return is required to do that? During the bull market, you see, what happens during a bull market is you don't need any return at all to entice people to stocks. In the year 2000, in January 2000, look at the stock return predictor. The stock return predictor looks at historical data to tell us the most likely 10-year return on stocks. And in January of 2000, the most likely 10-year return on stocks was a negative number. The equity risk premium was a negative number. TIPS would have provided you 4% real. Asset class with a government guarantee. Stocks provided you a negative 1% real. Most likely. It could be worse, could be better, but that was the most likely return. 5%, you got a 5% risk penalty. For your willingness to take on the risk of stocks, you were given a return 5 full percentage points less every year for 10 years in a row. So, see, the risk premium, just like I say, the return on stocks is not a stable number, or the safe withdrawal rate is not a stable number, the equity risk premium is not a stable number. Different equity risk premiums apply at different times. If we see another 50% drop in stock prices, which is certainly on the table. We don't know that's going to happen, but it could. If that happens, a risk premium of 6.5% is not going to be enough. It's not going to get people back into stocks. People are going to hate stocks with a burning passion. And the only way we'll be able to get people back in stocks is by offering a risk premium not of 6.5%, but of, like, you know, 15%. It's just going to be an outrageously high return. And stocks will have to provide that return for 10 years, 12 years running to get people back in. Because the losses we will suffer in the wake of the bull market will be so devastating for so long. And the rational investors will just be raking it in. Because there they'll be. They didn't suffer during the crash. So they can afford, they have money to invest in stocks when the equity risk premium is sky high. But that doesn't matter. See, in terms of setting the equity risk premium, the fact that, you know, the passive investors will say, oh, that can't be. But it can be. What makes it so is the irrationality of passive investing. If passive investing weren't so irrational, you never could have a 15% return on stocks for 10 years running. But because passive investing is so irrational and so painful to those who follow it, so financially devastating, it takes an insanely high risk premium to counter the negative psychology that results from these years of devastating losses. Now, I'll just wrap this up by saying, if rational investing catches on, I hope it will. I think it's critical for our economy that it catch on. I think it's critical for middle-class investors and their hopes of financing decent retirements that it catch on, that it catches on. If it catches on, it would make sense that the equity risk premium would drop in the future. For now, we don't have to worry about it. There's no signs of that happening anytime soon. You know, most passive investing remains dominant, although it's been discredited. It's been discredited for 30 years in the academic research, and it's been discredited in practical terms. People have seen, you know, great human misery, you know, for 9 years. Stocks have performed poorly for 9 years running and devastatingly bad in the past 2 years. So passive investing has been discredited, but it's still the dominant model. You still can't talk about rational investing at Motley Fool. You still can't talk about rational investing at Morningstar. You still can't talk about rational investing at Bogleheads.org. Still can't talk about rational investing at IndexUniverse.com. Still can't talk about rational investing at the Early Retirement Forum. Still can't talk about rational investing at Financial Webring Forum. So passive investing remains dominant. So right now we don't have to worry about it. But I do believe that if rational investing becomes popular, and I hope that that's going to happen, it would make sense that the equity risk premium would drop. But I think that's a good thing. It doesn't trouble me. Because the equity risk premium is so high that a little drop is not going to be that big a deal in my personal life. And I think it would be the payoff would be worth it, because what we would get in return is a greater measure of economic stability. You see, what's happening today is, yeah, the rational investors are doing great in terms of their stock returns, but the passive investors are driving our economy off a cliff. If we have another 50% price drop, we could go into a depression. If we go into a depression, all bets are off. Everybody loses. Passives, rationals, old school, new school, it makes no difference. So I would gladly trade, you know, a point or two of annual return in exchange for a more stable economy. And if rational investing were to become the dominant model, we would not see these insane swings in prices. If we became rational investors, the market would become self-regulating. Every time prices got too high, investors would know to sell. And selling would bring prices back down again. And then if they started to get too low, investors would know to buy, and buying would bring prices back up again. The market is self-regulating if investors understand how stocks work. See, that's the key. What the efficient market theory assumes is that the market is already self-regulating. It says we're all so smart. We know everything. Therefore, the price is always right. But the reality is, until we start adjusting our stock allocation in response to big price changes, we don't know nothing. We don't know the ABCs. We've got the basics wrong. The fundamentals. We don't know nothing. We're idiots, babe. There's a great line in in that Bob Dylan song from Blood on the Tracks. He ended it. It was a great line at the end. The song was sort of over the top in its negativity. I mean, but he ended it with, idiot wind blowing through the dust upon our shelves. We're idiots, babe. It's a wonder we can even feed ourselves. You know, he's talking about the area of personal relationships, but we're idiots, babe, in this investing business. We're idiots, babe. It's a wonder we can even feed ourselves. If in the year 2009 we don't understand yet that valuations affect long-term returns, we're idiots, babe. If we stop being idiots, the economy will be more stable. We'll all be wealthier. And we'll all be less angst-filled when investing in stocks. But the worst thing we can do, the dumbest thing we could do, is what we did. The dumbest thing is to assume we already know it all. And therefore, there's no need to warn people to sell stocks when prices get high. Prices can't get high. Market's rational. Can happen. It sure happened. I think we've explained the risk premium, but, I'm not God. I hope if you see flaws in the argument, you'll let me know. Drop me a note. Drop me an email. Go to the Contact Rob button on the left side of every page at the PassionSaving.com site. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care. Take care, babe.